My name's Liana Berry, and you're listening to Art Muse Podcast, a podcast about the intersections between art, healing, and creativity. Hello and welcome back to Art Muse Podcast. Today we have the last episode for season two. It's gone so fast and I will miss being in your ears each week, but I plan just to take a short break. It does take a bit of coordination to organize guests, to record episodes, and quite a few hours each week editing, and I am also traveling a bit within Australia at the moment. So I will be back in your ears soon, but I'm going to leave you with this episode, which is a Q&A. Thank you so much to everyone that sent in a question. I think I should be able to get through most of the topics today. There's a few people that shared similarities in their questions, so I will sort of collect you together. I got a few questions about art therapy, a few about creativity, and also quite a few about me as a person. It seems some of you are a bit more curious about some aspects of my life. So I am quite private, but I will do my best to answer them and we can get to know each other a little better. So the first question I'm going to answer was asked by Erin, and there was a similar question also asked by Rebecca and Nicholas. So the question is something that I think a lot of you will probably identify with, and it is strategies to combat negative self-talk that stops you from creating. So thank you for that question, Erin. Yeah, it is a really difficult thing sometimes, isn't it, just to commence art making, to really override that negative self-talk. It can be really destructive and it can be one of the biggest barriers to engaging with art making and creativity. There are lots of different approaches to combating that negative self-talk. The two that I'm going to suggest today, one of them is actually drawing your negative self-talk as a character. So what you're doing is you're depersonalizing that inner voice and separating it from yourself. So this allows you, I think, to be able to step away from it, to be able to question it, and to be able to locate yourself separately from it, which is quite important. But sometimes when it feels really nasty, like when that self-criticism becomes like really nasty and really detailed and really intrusive, it feels like us, you know, like it's very hard to separate yourself from, and you end up just listening to it because it feels like the truth. You know, if it didn't feel like the truth, we probably wouldn't listen to it, but it feels like hard and fast law. It feels really truthful. So by creating it as like a character or a creature, you're naturally just creating a bit of separation. And it's a way to visualize it. It's a way to dialogue it. I've talked about that a little bit in the podcast, that art making is this way of externalizing something so that there can be an active dialogue. And you can create that dialogue in your just internally by just thinking about it. It can be a thought process, or it can be a written dialogue where you're actually writing. If you're working with a therapist, obviously that becomes quite verbal and the therapist becomes involved in that dialogue and they can prompt questions and things, but you are able to do it yourself. So have a go at if your inner critic, that negative self-talk, was a person or a creature or a monster or an alien, like what would it look like? If you're really struggling, if you really struggle to put yourself on paper, then just visualize it. You know, it'd be great if you could get some pens or pencils or colors out, or even like Paula McClay, if you're 3D orientated, and actually create like a visual representation of it. But if that is going to be too much for you, you can just close your eyes and think about it. So, you know, there's that old symbolism of the devil and the angel on your shoulder. So you might depict it in some sort of similar symbolism, but you might also create it as like a monster with five mouths that yell at you, or some sort of other creature that is just really sinister and really sneaky. They might be invisible, they might have form, they might be spiky, they might be a certain color. Have a go and just see what comes out. And then as soon as you visualize that, when you experience that inner voice, when you have that inner voice really active, you can bring forth that image of that monster or that creature or that character or that little person. And then you're able to create a dialogue with it that's separate from yourself. So you're able to make requests of it. You're able to ask it to be silent. You're able to listen to it and then respond. So there just becomes this real active potential around it, this real kind of dynamic evolution of something that's workable. So I would really strongly recommend doing that. The other thing that I would really recommend doing, and you can do either or you can do a combination of both and see which one fits with you better, because one of these activities may fit with you better. You may think, I get brilliantly on it. I know exactly what sort of monster to draw my inner critic with. I'm going to pin it above my desk. And when my brain is being really pervasive and intrusive and bitter and angry and resentful about my art making, I'm going to look at that picture and I'm going to tell it that I need it to be quiet right now. And you can ask it, like, what do you need to be quiet? Like, what do you want from me? Or you can, you know, have a box that you put it in. So there's an activity that I do when I have people in a workshop, and I ask them to write down the concerns and worries that they've brought to the workshop. So what is that inner voice, that inner critic that's bothering them as they've arrived? Is it that they don't know anyone? Is it that they're going to be laughed at? Is it that they're not going to have any ideas? They're going to be stuck. They're going to be frozen. They're worried about the kids at home. They're hungry. They've had a terrible day. They're exhausted. You know, whatever it is, I ask them to write it down on a piece of paper and put it in a box. And so it's that physical, like, shifting of it. It's like I'm writing it down, I'm materializing it, and then I'm putting it away. So it's that symbolism of, like, locking it away and putting it away. So you can do the same thing with the portrait of your monster or your creature, is that each time you go to make art, you can put that creation in a cage or in a box. And it might sound a bit silly, but it is an external way of, like, enacting, symbolizing, like, what you need. And it can be actually be really helpful. It can be really, really helpful for a lot of people. Or you can just do that simple task that I do with those groups, where you write down, you get it out, you put it on paper, and you put it away, and you tell yourself, like, yes, I heard you. And yep, validate that thought. I'm going to put it to the side right now. Doesn't mean it's going to be diminished forever, but I'm putting it in a box because I'm going to be making art, and that's of value to me right now. And I'm not going to ruminate on those thoughts because they're having a rest. They're locked in the box. The other way of combating some of those negative thoughts is to actually do some deeper digging into where they come from. So quite commonly, we identify our inner voices as our own, but actually, their origins are usually from someone else. So sometimes our inner critic and our internal voices and our internal kind of magical thinking, like how we make meaning, the restrictions we place on ourselves, the consequences we think will happen if we do or don't do something a certain way, like the shoulds and coulds and needs to, they're often internalized voices that we've experienced as children. And so that can be through family members, or that can be through media and cultural kind of like social conditioning. And so it's really helpful sometimes to write down all of those kind of reoccurring negative self-talk and to have a reflection on, like, where does this come from? Like, is there a thought behind it? So let's do an example. So if your negative self-talk is, I'm not good at this, I suck at this, it's not good enough, it's terrible, it looks ugly. So you write those things down, and then you're like, okay, so is that my voice? Yeah, I think so. I think I feel those things. But where did I learn that my artwork was ugly? Or my artwork was not good enough? You know, was there someone that was overly critical? Or was there someone that held me to a certain standard as a child? Was there an art teacher that said, this is the standard of beauty, this is the standard that you should be at? And, you know, sometimes it'll be really specific like that, like, oh yes, actually I remember my uncle would laugh at every single drawing I did and think it was funny and tell me that my horse looked like a cat with three legs. And over time, I just felt like I could never represent what I wanted to represent, and people would just laugh at it or not see it for what it is or misinterpret it. So I have carried with me this journey that my artwork is going to be misinterpreted and I'm not good enough to get the meaning I want to across. So it might be something really explicit like that, or it might be something more complicated than that. It might be that as a child, you had more of an awareness of the adults around you feeling good and when they didn't feel good, and that you felt achieving a certain way gave them a spark of joy. And that is something that incidentally happens a lot. And sometimes as a consequence, it can get paired up. So for example, you were a prolific drawer as a child, and every time you gave your mum or dad an artwork, they would celebrate it and they would love it and it would be joyful and they would stick it on the fridge. But your childhood was marked with a lot of difficulty and with a lot of disruption and a lot of stress. So over time, you kind of developed this responsibility that I want my artwork to be so good it makes my mum feel good, or I want this to be perfect so they'll be even more proud of me, so that we can just have this moment of exchange where they feel like they can celebrate me, there's something tangible for us to connect over. And make them proud. And so for some people, that is if they had lots of struggles as a child and they didn't feel like they got celebrated or encouraged about a lot of things except for drawing, then they will lift up their standard. They will create a really high standard because subconsciously they're sort of looking to constantly get approval through their artwork. So when you're kind of writing down your inner critics and it sounds like your voice, but the driver behind it is old. It stems right back to your childhood. And the way to disempower those inner critic voices is to try and shed some light on their origins and their pathways, whether it's connected with someone else and someone else's voice. It's actually your uncle's voice in your head or your friend's voice in your head. Maybe your friend was always extra skilled at certain things that you really, really wanted to be skilled at, and they would sort of criticize your artwork regularly. Or maybe it's still your voice, but the motivators are related to other emotional needs as a child. So you're disempowering it by identifying where else it's coming from and then labeling it about whether it's actually useful or not anymore. Is that old? Like, does that serve you? So often our inner critics aren't serving us, and they're certainly not truths. I mean, our logical brain knows that. Like, if we look at the art world and, you know, who's considered insanely successful artists that make more than a comfortable living off their artwork and are celebrated all over the world, there is such diversity, you know, from abstract to realism, so much room for different taste. So it's looking at what you value and why you value it and where that inner critic is coming from. Like, if you value realism and you expect your artwork to be realistic, is that because you enjoy the drive to get there and you enjoy the outcome? Or is that because somewhere along the line you've learnt that that's the gold standard of art making? That you being realistic is the only, you know, should be the only valued artwork? In which case, you need to question that, and whether that thought pattern is helpful for you or whether you challenge it. It's not going to go away straight away. So often what you'll need to do when you want to engage with art making is, like having that visual of that monster, is actually pulling out that compassionate discussion with yourself, going, okay, I can hear these voices coming back. I can hear this distaste for what I'm doing. I can hear this criticism and these barriers. And how am I going to be compassionate about it enough for me to be able to engage with the process? And part of that is also identifying why you want to make art. So if you want to make art because it's relaxing, it's enjoyable, it's therapeutic, you want something for yourself, you're trying to be explorative, you want more play in your life, then before you make art, you probably need to remind yourself of that. So validate and go, I know I'm not going to feel good enough about this. I know that this is an age-old story I've had that no longer serves me, but goes way back to my childhood where I was convinced that this is how you make art, or these people were incidentally set a standard for me or were unkind to me. I acknowledge that. This is going to be difficult. That doesn't serve me anymore, so I'm actively going to challenge that. And I really want to be playful, and I really want to be nurtured by my art making, so I'm going to do it anyway. So it's not necessarily about ignoring those internal dialogues, because they often just become louder and louder, and we'll become more and more frustrated. If we don't understand where they're coming from, we are just going to kind of get caught up in the emotional reactivity to them, and we'll often kind of get tired and fall into listening to them. But if we can be compassionate and validating to ourselves, and know that it's an ongoing persuasion and an ongoing habit change, because our thought patterns and our internal dialogue do become habitual and art do take a long time to change, and we remind ourselves of the value and what it is that we're seeking, and we have kindness and compassion about getting there and that it's going to be a slow process, then I feel like that's the best toolbox. That would be my kind of first port of call, Erin and Nicholas and Rebecca, that, and anyone else that's has this difficulty, is try and do some self-exploration around it. Be kind to yourself and remind yourself of what you're looking for now. And, you know, if you've got an overly rational brain, you can remind yourself about all of the artists in the world and their diversity, and that there is no standards, and that everyone does go through periods of being stuck and having difficulty and not liking their work. And quite often our response to our work is reflective of where we're at So even if we feel like we have a good relationship with our art making, if we have a day where all of a sudden then that shifts, we've been really enjoying a project, we've been really loving it, and then we go into our little art nook, back into our art making session a couple of days later, and we're really all of a sudden agitated and not liking it and it looks ugly, and nothing has actually physically changed with that artwork yet, I would question whether your response to your artwork is a response to your current feeling state, and question whether it needs some space and time, whether you're going to work on something else that maybe expresses that feeling more directly before we go and sabotage the artwork we're doing. Because we've all been there. I've been there plenty of times where I have been creating an artwork and my mood is being projected onto the artwork. So I just become agitated and frustrated and really annoyed at it. And then I kind of self-sabotage because the emotion is not matching the project I'm doing, and so it's just going to play out the way it's going to play out, but usually that ends in destruction. So that's another thing to be mindful of, is if you're finding a lot of shifting emotions, look at your inner landscape, and is it just a reflection of what's happening internally, and is there anything else you can do to support yourself? Do you need to be working in a journal instead of on your painting that is really detailed and needs lots of care and patience? You know, do you need to just do some scribbling and some artwork that doesn't have any outcome just to move some of that feeling through? Or do you need to go for a walk first? Or do you need to sing while you're doing it? Do you need to have something to eat? Have a big drink of water? Do you need to debrief with someone first? So just being mindful of your emotional landscape, because it will often play out in your art making. And, you know, that can be great if you're harnessing your art making to express those emotions. But if you're not really, and you are more focused on the art making as a project, as an art project, then yeah, definitely your internal landscape is still going to play out, and sometimes, yeah, if not careful, you can incidentally sabotage yourself. And yeah, I guess the third point, I probably could have done a whole episode actually on this question, because it is a really potent question and it is quite a big answer. But the third point I'll make before I move on is just to be mindful of your art projects. So if you do feel like you have an inner critic that's really active, then yeah, be considered about what sort of art projects you're going to tackle when that voice feels particularly loud. So there are so many different art and craft materials, and you might choose one that has more of a sense of mastery or comes more easily for you or is filled with more joy and more passion when that inner critic is really loud, rather than kind of choosing the most difficult or most detailed project or trying to prove it wrong. So we don't want to be making art to prove our inner critic wrong. We don't want to be saying, well, I'm going to choose this one because I will show myself how good I am at, because then you're just getting into a relationship treating it like it's the truth, and it's not. As we've just explored, it's usually got historic roots somewhere, and it's usually something that's not serving us. Like, being critical about ourselves isn't serving us. It is useful to be able to look at something with a critical eye and a discerning eye and be able to change things and figure out what's working and be pragmatic and problem solve. But most of the time when we're talking about inner critics, we're talking about a voice that's like demoralizing and has low self-esteem and is really inhibiting. Because if we think about a discerning eye, that's a really proactive process. You know, that's about whether you change the blue to a green, or whether you do an extra line of stitching and make it longer, or, you know, whether you add a lip to your vase when you're making pottery. Like, there, that's a discerning eye that might involve some criticism of going, does this work? Does this not work? I need some time to kind of like think about it, and I might undo some of it to redo some of it. But it's not related to your value. It's not related to, I'm not a good person, or I'm not good at art making, or I can't do anything right, or this is too hard and I just can't do hard things. So we just want to really, I guess, start to pull apart that dialogue and try and locate, you know, which camp it's in. If it's in a proactive, helpful camp and it just needs a bit of fine tuning, or if it's really having a go at us and it's trying to force us into believing something about ourselves, or it's trying to protect us. So quite often our inner critic voices are a way to protect ourselves. So if we think back to that uncle that might have laughed every time you showed a picture to your family, it's like, by learning not to feel good about your artwork and to be self-critical, you're protecting yourself from feeling hurt and rejected from other people. Because ultimately, feeling hurt and rejected from other people is more painful than feeling rejected by yourself. So it's like a self-preservation. You are kind of getting in first. Your brain's like, well, I'll get in first. I will do it in a way that you can normalize it and you can become accustomed to not being good enough before it becomes a social thing and someone else says it or someone else lets you down or hurts you. So I think when we start to realize some of these mechanisms, we can definitely be more compassionate towards ourselves and we can feel like we have more of an active pathway to break them down and to navigate around them and to engage in our art making anyway. The other last thing I would encourage is for you to keep artwork you don't like. So that was a big thing for me. I used to tear out pages of my diaries. I used to screw up every single artwork that had a mistake on it and that I didn't like. And over time, what I've challenged myself to do is to keep some of that and to build my tolerance and my relationship with it. So have it within my vicinity and then to watch my dialogue with it and to watch myself feel very uncomfortable and to question what happens if I leave it. And what am I scared of? And does it matter? And can I push myself to accommodate something that's imperfect or something that's got mistakes or something that's ugly? And yes, eventually it usually does end up in the bin, but that journey of actually holding on to it for longer has taught me a lot. And to watch my inner dialogue with it and to watch my discomfort and to challenge myself around that and to be more compassionate. Yeah, and I think sometimes it also allows you to see that variation and it also exposes the benefit of time. So sometimes I've actually kept hold of stuff that when I've looked back a number of months later and I've like had that icky feeling in my stomach, like, oh gosh, why did I keep this? I know it's going to be horrible. I will like uncover the painting or like look in my diary and I'll be like, oh, it's not even that bad. Like the criticism kind of died out with time. And again, it was a mirror of my feeling state. And actually what I see with fresh eyes is something that can be reworked, something that isn't as emotionally potent, or it's something that just doesn't hold any meaning. And I've realized I've surpassed it and developed some skills and moved forward in a way that I'm happy with. And then disposing of it is filled with less vitriol than if I just become angry and agitated that it's ugly and it's awful and, you know, listening to that self-critic and chucked it out straight away. Actually holding on to it and allowing some of the feeling to dissipate, reviewing it with fresh eyes, deciding whether I do want to keep it, but then just having some self-compassion and learning from that dialogue with self. So a lot of self-reflection. A lot of self-reflection is the answer to that question. Okay, jumping into one of the other questions I've had, which is a bit different. This one is from Eden, and it was, what was the process of training to be an art therapist like? So I did touch on this in my introduction podcast episode right at the start, and I do apologize. I am learning along the way, so some of the editing quality has improved over time and the sound quality varies quite a bit anyway because I move around and travel a bit. But yeah, if you do want to go back and sort of hear more about my journey to art therapy, it's detailed more in that episode. I really enjoyed my studies as an art therapist. They were very intense. I really enjoyed doing it at a master's level, at a tertiary level, and I think that was really helpful to my career and to my development of self and as an artist and as an art therapist, and it was really rich. The courses have changed. I studied 10 years ago now. They're constantly changing. They change depending on the lecturers, the university structures themselves. It has got a lot of placement, which is actually can be frustrating, particularly if you're a mature age student, which a lot of people that study art therapy are. You have to have an undergraduate degree to study a master's level art therapy course, and there is a lot of placement, which can sometimes for some people feel like overwhelming because it takes up a lot of time away from family and a time from ability to work. So juggling that kind of ability to make money and fund your life and your living as well as study can be tricky, but the placement actually is one of the I love the theoretical side of it and writing essays and exploring the history of art therapy and the psychology behind it and the counseling techniques and the research and the different approaches, and I just found it really eye-opening. It really showed you the diversity of approaches and I learned so much from it. But the placement adds an exceptional layer to that because you're kind of actively as a student exploring some of those theories in situ, I guess, and you're being exposed to how art therapy can fit into teams and clinical spaces, including the limitations, including some of the barriers and the complexities of working in teams that might not have that understanding. Because when you're studying and you're sort of in your cohort being taught by lecturers, everyone's there for art therapy, everyone's passionate, everyone's either upskilled and educated on it if you're the lecturers, or actively learning about it as the students. So you're in this like lovely bubble, which definitely embrace if you do it, because you know it soon disappears and then you're out in the world by yourself. But I think it's quite important to have students stepping out of that bubble and into clinical workspaces and sort of understanding how that translates to client work and the systems and the organizations that art therapy can fit into, but how art therapy has to sort of adapt and like mold to fit into some of those environments. It is heavy. It is a heavy coursework to do. I did it quite young. I don't regret it, but there would definitely be differences if I studied it now, knowing more about myself as well. So I guess have a think about what's going on in your life, how much you can take on, what you want to learn. As I mentioned in that earlier episode, there is variations with qualifications, the settings that you want to work in, the way that you want to use it. I advocate for people to be as ethical and as well trained as possible. So in a lot of ways, I do really encourage people, if they can, to do that master's level qualification, because it does meet so many of those education requirements and skill requirements, and you do come out feeling really well equipped. And it does open a lot of extra doors as well. If you don't want to work in clinical spaces, then there are other options. But yeah, I'm not going to jump into that question too much today. It is a big one. I do feel like it is probably worth doing quite a bit of research, also contacting course coordinators. Definitely have a look at the ANZA CADA website if you're in New Zealand, Australia, or Southeast Asia. And if you are in the USA or the UK, they also have art therapy professional bodies that should have lots of information about studying art therapy. And you could also try reaching out to art therapists or seeing if there's any other art therapists that have information or are happy to share information on their experiences of studies. But it really is such a lot of personal decision making. But I did really enjoy my study. Okay, next question up we have from Luetta, and she's asked my thoughts on using creativity as an income. So she's asked, "Hi Liana, I'm just wondering, do you think working in a creative space diminishes your creativity? I.e., would you recommend getting a job in the art sector if you're creative, or is it better to work a day job and do your creativity on the side?" That's a good question. I think it depends on the person. And so it's not a very clear-cut answer, unfortunately. I think there's lots of different dialogues on this one. I think some people adamantly believe that working in creative industries and creative jobs does kill off creativity, and other people that fully embrace it. And I just think it depends probably on the environment. So I think if you do want to go into working in a creative field, you just need to be mindful around like what it is you value about art making, and you need to make sure you have a good foundation of who you are as a creative. And I would encourage you to have a reasonable amount of self-esteem and creative grounding, I guess, in that you're willing to trust your own inner creative voice. So I think a lot of the time this has to do with the work environments, when people feel like creative jobs and industries and roles kills it off their creativity or diminishes it. It's because of high levels of stress. Who has like the creative responsibility, or who has the creative control, I guess. So if you're being given briefs where everything's like really narrowed down for you and you don't get any creative license, you don't get any freedom, that probably is going to be quite stifling for a lot of people. But if you, for example, work as like a freelance illustrator or a freelance graphic designer, and you get to say no to clients that don't seem like a good fit, you get to offer, like, you know, you might get a bit of a brief, but you get to offer something that's in your style, and you get to discuss and collaborate on options rather than just being given narrow parameters, then like those two experiences are going to be very different. You're probably going to feel like a lot more creative freedom, a lot more creative empowerment. So I think it really depends on like the environment that you might work in, who you might work with, like the structure of that. And I think identifying that before you start your studies or before you go into a job is really helpful. Like, okay, so what are the things I need to feel like fulfillment with my creativity? Do I need to have full artistic license? Do I need to have very little parameters, or am I happy with really strong parameters being given to me? Do I work well to time frames, or do I need really open-ended time frames? So I guess your answers to some of these questions are then going to roll on to some of the choices you make. So, you know, if you work as a graphic designer in a company, you're going to have deadlines to meet. You're going to have to work to meet those deadlines, and that might be really stifling and really restrictive to you. If you were just an artist at home, you could design your products and create a batch of them and then put them out for sale or put them in stock in shops. Then that might be more suited to the way that you work, because you don't have that pressure of that deadline. So have a think about the way that you work. I don't think there is a clear answer. I think for some people, or a lot of people, certain job environments can stifle their creativity. But for others, there's like this real sense of reward and empowerment. And I think that's why having that foundation of feeling like your creativity is good enough, that you make it for yourself, and that it's a gift to share it with others, and it's an enjoyment to and a challenge to be able to share it and help other people solve their problems with it, will support you a lot in your journey. Because if you are relying on other people to validate and give you positive feedback within like a job dynamic, there's going to be times where people don't like what you're doing, they don't think it works. And if you're going to take that personally and use that as language, internal language, as we were just speaking about with the first question, internalize that as a value for your art making, you're going to get sticky very quickly. So you want to be able to just have a good sense of self, a good sense of creativity before you work in any creative industries, because they are often quite challenging. A lot of people find them very rewarding, so don't let it also put you off. That's something I didn't realize for a long time, was that actually there is a lot of thriving and excitement and fulfillment that can happen in creative workplaces, and there is such a diversity in creative industries as well. And I do know quite a few artists that have part-time jobs. I think there's a real value in doing part-time work if you're financially able to, and creating that consistency of income that then alleviates the stress of having to make your personal creative expression be the sole income earner. So you can sort of balance it out with having a part-time job that you can do, and then also do your personalized artistic practice on the side, and you can still attempt to make money with that, but the pressure's not entirely on it. I've seen artists sometimes that have training in certain creative industries, so whether it's advertising or illustration or graphic design or pottery production, what are some other creative industries? Bookbinding, canvas stretching, art shop retail, embroidery, printing. There's all of these sort of different industries that are creatively associated that you can work in, but then you can also have your artistic practice on the side. There's a lot of different ways that people do it. Most people aren't really visible about it either. So yeah, don't rely on social media to tell you how people are making an income or the different ways they mix and match their work and their vocations. And some people really do prefer work full-time not as a creative and then create solely on the side. So they might work as like a teacher, a nurse, a electrician, an admin assistant, a shopkeeper, a retail assistant, a typist, any sort of role that they might work in part-time to full-time, and they never have the drive to work in a creative industry, and they create solely on the side. So that's also about, I guess, what you want out of your art making. So art making doesn't always have to be a vocation as far as like earning money. It doesn't always have to be something that you show people. That it can just be for you, something that you do in your lounge room in the evenings, and you can be perfectly content with exploring and playing and being self-expressive. It doesn't always have to be more. You don't have to make it into a job. You don't have to share it with other people. It can just be for you. So I really want to highlight that as well. Okay, we've got a couple more questions. The next question is related to the podcast, and that is from Henrietta. Hi, Liana. I'm listening from the UK, and I wanted to ask you about creating a podcast. Is it difficult? Would you recommend it? And is it easy to find guests? I was thinking about making one Okay, so Henrietta hasn't said what she does. Feel free to get in touch with what you're doing and your Instagram handle or something so we can all check you out. Yes, making a podcast is actually really rewarding and I'm so, so glad I've done it. I really enjoy it. I guess there's a couple of different things I've learnt along the way. One of the things I've learnt is the similarities we all have. So I often find with my guests that there's similarities of conversations that we fall into on mic and off mic. So I often have a chat after we finish recording and I often find myself chatting about similar things. So it's nice to see those threads of humanity and yeah, those kind of shared creative experiences, and those has been really rewarding and connecting with other creatives. I think I have been really excited by the amount of ideas that I get to share and being able to have a voice to share them, and I've had some really positive feedback as well. A lot of people making or at home by themselves, walking or making artwork or, you know, doing some domestic task, and they just say they really enjoy listening and makes them feel less alone as an creative as well. Some of you feel like you don't have many other creative people in your life, so that's been really lovely. I guess two of the more challenging things I've found with creating a podcast is having had no audio knowledge myself and just trying to get that consistency in sound and just the editing. I think when you're trying to formulate difficult concepts verbally, there is a lot of pauses, there's a lot of ums, there's like a lot of re-saying things in different ways. So there is definitely so much benefit in editing podcasts. It makes for a much smoother listen, but it does take much longer than I anticipated. So if you are interested in supporting the podcast, please shout me a Ko-fi or you can buy one of my books. It does just help to alleviate some of that impact of those hours that I spend editing and also contacting people. And yeah, the other thing I think sometimes it is a slow build. Well, it's been a slow build for me. So I have got lots of lovely listeners now. I'm really happy with the reach, but it just does take a while. It's not instant. It's like the same if you're sharing anything, you do have to be patient and wait for it to build. And in those early days, it does just feel like you're talking a bit into a void. Obviously recording by yourself and you're not getting a lot of feedback from listeners. So, I mean, I think about all the podcasts I've listened to and I have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed, and I do not contact any of the podcast hosts to tell them that I really liked it. So, you know, I shouldn't be surprised sometimes when there's radio silence, but it does mean that you have to rely on your own motivation. And sometimes that can be a little bit difficult if I'm having a bit of a flat week. And probably the other third difficulty is that sometimes I don't remember what I've said and I'm like, I don't want to repeat myself. But yeah, the podcast is evolving and I'm learning, and it's nice to share that learning process. There's definitely less, unless you hire a company that produces podcasts, which some people do, especially people that are already got like a celebrity status or they've already got a very high income flourishing business. They often pay thousands of dollars for someone else to produce their podcasts and the videos that go along with them and things. But so if you don't have that, you just have to learn along the way, and then your learning is much more visible than perhaps having like a polished photo on Instagram that you can delete or go back and edit. You can't really go back and edit podcast episodes. So yeah, that's been an interesting experience for myself, I think, in being vulnerable and having my episodes out there. But I really hope to continue for a long time. I've got a lot to say and I'm really interested in how the podcast is developing. And so I would encourage you to have a go. Do a bit of research. There are like lots of blogs that have information about how to record podcasts to begin with or to trial and in like really accessible way and really accessible steps. So Henrietta, definitely give it a go, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about like the context for your podcast ideas. The next question is from Lulu, and she said, how do you find your guests? Is there a way to apply? So I'm glad I got this one. Actually, I have been actively searching for guests like throughout season one and season two. Some of them, as you will have heard in the episodes, are friends or old long-time acquaintances and colleagues and sort of people I know through networks. I've had a couple of people reach out and contact me, but largely I've also just been keeping my eyes peeled for artists and creatives that I think will really complement the subjects that we're talking about, and have sent out a lot of emails asking if people are interested and reaching out that way and networking that way. Some no replies as well, and I've obviously had some gorgeous people get back to me who have the time and the interest in being guests, which I really appreciate because at the end of the day, it's a donation of people's time. There's no financial remuneration for being on a podcast, although it is a great way to share your story and just to connect with other people. You're always welcome to reach out if you think that you could be suitable for the podcast. Unfortunately, I can't have everyone that reaches out on. I am selective sometimes depending on the subjects I'm talking about, or I guess whether I think my listeners will be relevant to my listeners. So I do encourage you to be mindful of that when you reach out, but I would love to discuss potential with you if you have any ideas, whether you just like to hear certain topics, or whether you know someone that might suit, or whether you yourself think you might suit an episode. I'm always happy to hear from you. So that's how I find my podcast guests. The last two questions I think I'm going to run through today. There's been a few more, but perhaps I'll do another Q&A for season 3. So the other question I had was from someone, I think you say it Rizol. They have asked me for a quick 5 answer. So the first one is favorite color. I don't have one. I do quite like turquoise colors at the moment. I tend to change. I tell my clients I work with all the time that my color preferences change. Sometimes it's yellow, sometimes it's green. I went through a phase of loving purple, and like the last few years, purple really turns me off. So yeah, feel free to change your mind about things. I'm a good example of that. I don't have a favorite color. It also depends on the context of what the color is being used for. Favorite food? Okay, these are fun questions. Favorite food is probably pasta. Recently, actually, for health reasons, I went gluten-free and dairy-free. And I am also already vegetarian, so I've been vegetarian my whole life. So yeah, it changed my diet up a little bit. I'm thankful that there's lots of alternatives. It definitely was a big adjustment. I do miss a few things. I do now eat really dark percentage chocolate, which I thought I'd never do. So I've certainly challenged myself in that way, but I do really love pasta, and thankfully there are some really good gluten-free pasta options. Yeah, what else do I love? Sweet-wise, I used to love scones. That was like a big identity thing for me, saying that scones were my favourite food. My nana used to make scones. She was English, and when she used to come and visit in the school holidays in the summer, she would always make a batch of scones. Sometimes she'd arrive while we were at school, and we'd race home, and you know, I don't know if it was every year, but certainly on a few occasions she'd already made a batch for us. So exciting, so delicious. And I would often always get scones when I went out for tea with someone to a cafe. So that was a bit hard actually, when I went gluten-free, to be able to not say that scones were my favorite food. But yeah, I'm just going to stick with pasta for now. It's delicious. Okay, that was question 2. Question 3, all favorite artist. Okay, so these are almost all favorite questions. Thanks for the quick 5. I'm going to have to get quicker. I should just give one word answers. I don't have one. I do love the Impressionists, I think, because I studied them in high school and they left a really lasting impact on me. And I just really like how they kind of are very atmospheric and changed up the way that people paint. There are so many modern contemporary artists I just love, and I have like a big collection. It is part of my job quite often to provide people with artist inspiration, and so many artists that I love. These are a couple that Claire Celeste, who does immersive installations. I love the illustrator Lavi Poda. I don't know if that's how you say her name. She's an illustrator currently in London. And I also love the artist Sergi Chiocina. He's a painter as well, influenced by the Impressionist style. So there's a few artists there that I really enjoy, but there's just so many. The last few questions from the quickfire were, if I wasn't an art therapist, what else would I do? Perhaps something with animals or nature. I also love making coffee, even though I don't drink it, so maybe I'd be a little cafe owner, a bookstore owner. I don't know, does everyone dream about being a bookstore owner or a florist or a coffee maker? I don't know, I think we all do. So yeah, any of those things maybe, or just an artist illustrator, which I'm kind of working on a lot at the moment anyway. So yeah, any of those things. And the very last question was, if I could travel anywhere in the world, where would I go? and I don't know, there's so many beautiful places. I do love Europe, so I think I'd go and explore Europe a bit more in the Mediterranean, soothes my soul. Been to New Zealand, but I'd love to go back. And yeah, there's so many exotic places. I'm quite an anxious traveller though, so it's going to take me a long time to get myself on a plane and to each of those countries. If anyone invents teleportation, let me know. I'm quite a fearful flyer. Okay, so I think we're going to wrap up there because we're pretty close to time and I've so enjoyed answering all of those questions. Oh wait, there was one question from Anna that I wanted to answer, and that was what art materials I would purchase if I didn't have any. Anna says, I want to get into more art making. I don't really have anything except for a pencil and some coloured pencils. What would you recommend? I would recommend not going out and buying everything under the sun. I'd probably recommend just slow building. So choose something that sparks your joy or your interest and have a go with it for a while and then add on to it, especially if you don't know what sort of art style you're going to make. Keep an eye out on marketplaces online, you know, if you've got Facebook Marketplace or I don't know what it's called in other countries. We have one called Gumtree. I think America's one is called Craigslist. So sometimes people are moving on their art materials, but yeah, if you do want to buy a few more than just one at a time, I would recommend having some sort of paint system, like a watercolor palette or an ink palette, and like a couple of synthetic paint brushes are quite long lasting and quite soft. Bristle ones are more natural, but they can be quite harsh, and yeah, it's really personal preference, but I would probably splurge a little bit and get nicer paint brushes and just get a couple that are going to last you a long while and give you a quality of painting. I would probably recommend getting some form of crayon or pastel, so you could either choose a dry one or an oily one. An oily one is much more smudgy, and a dry one you're going to have to fix it, which means you're going to have to spray something over so it doesn't just wipe off like chalk. And they've got very different textures, so I don't know, everyone's different. Some people like neither texture, one like more than the other. You can fix like soft pastels or chalk pastels with a can of hairspray, or you can buy some artist base fixer. Obviously buy some paper pads. Thicker paper is a good idea if you're doing painting because it doesn't warp as quickly, and you just get a bit better feedback. As far as pencil work goes, if you're just working in pencil, then you may like to buy different grades of pencil, so like the weight of the pencil, so like HB, 2B, 4B, 6B, they indicate like how dark the pencil is on paper, like the grading. But I often can get it, I think if you can change the pressure, sometimes you don't need the full variation. So that's why I'm saying sort of try one or two things and sort of see what sort of artwork you want to make. Because if you do just get into shading and pencil work, then you might go out and buy a broad range of pencils. But if you aren't really and just going to sketch an outline and then paint it, then you're not going to really need all of those different kind of pencil grades. You can explore things like charcoal, obviously. And then there's all the 3D media, so that it, like, art materials does stretch such a long way. But I think if you are looking mostly at paper-based work, 2D work, I would recommend getting like pencil and eraser, obviously, and then some sort of watercolor or paint palette, and some good quality paint brushes, and some paper. You can get some reasonably good quality paper that comes in like a pad of like 10 pieces. That's like watercolor 310 GSM. Like the GSM just means like how thick the paper is and how much it is absorbent. So the higher the number, the thicker the paper will be. So often sometimes in sketchbooks and things that, like, you know, I just bought at like local supermarket type stores, they can be quite thin, and then they don't hold like the materials very well, so they might only be like 80 GSM. So you do kind of want to keep an eye on that, and if you can get something a bit higher that can take like the weight of expression. But having a mixture of both, because if you are just going to be like trying to engage with that therapeutic art making versus those art projects, and you're just sort of maybe doing some bilateral drawing like we were talking about in the body episode, where you're drawing with both your hands at the same time and just sort of scribbling and experimenting, then You may like to just go through paper a bit quicker, and you're doing it for the process rather than the product. So then you may want like a pack of that 80 GSM paper that it doesn't matter too much if it, you know, gets shredded at the end of the week with your guinea pigs or something, your rabbit warren, because you're not using it for like a longer term process. So there's lots to think about, but I would, if you're looking at 2D material, I'd obviously focus on that. Then there's obviously all the 3D material that you can go into, and you know, even with 2D, even with painting, there's like acrylics and oils, and there's just all these variations. But just get used to, if you're not engaged with art making, just get used to making something, and like, don't focus so much on the materials. Just have an exploration and have an experiment with what you enjoy and what you're drawn to expressing, and how you create, and the materials that kind of gel with you. And if you've got creative friends, see if you can borrow and interchange materials between each other, or have a craft afternoon together and make some tea and just try each other's materials out, so you don't have to go out and buy a whole lot that you don't use. Some people interchange a lot with between the materials they use, and they like to layer it up, and they collage, and they use different colored papers, and you know, they embellish things with beads and use wire and like all of these different diverse materials. And then other creative people use one or two materials, and that's what they kind of stick with for like months or years at a time. So you sort of need to get to know yourself. You don't want to assume that you're one person and you actually turn out to be the other, and you know, you can end up with spending a whole lot of money, or end up with a whole lot of sources that you don't use. But you also don't want to be restrictive, so start small and be willing to like experiment and progress and change your mind. Be always willing to change your mind, and yeah, keep your eyes peeled for easy opportunities to try things, or if you can go to some different workshops or classes if they think, you know, like for example, if you think you might like to try pottery, then if you can find some sort of pottery studio, just to experiment with the medium before you go out and buy your own materials, because sometimes you can be surprised at your own reaction or what it is that you gel with, which is the beauty. You know, we get to learn so much about ourselves through art making. Hope that answers your question. Thank you all so much for listening and for coming along for the Art Muse podcast so far. I really hope you enjoyed this season, and I really look forward to sharing some more episodes with you soon. Take care until then. Thank you so much for listening to Art Muse podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, then please like, share, or follow on whichever listening app you use. If you want to keep up to date on social media, the best place to find us is on Instagram at artmuse_podcast.